try to give you a review of lung transplantation, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And just bear with me. Hopefully we can get through this whirlwind on transplantation over the next 30 minutes. I don't have any disclosures at this time. I have no financial disclosures, although the drugs I may be discussing have no indication in the use in lung transplantation. So let's first start off with the history of transplantation. That's the first way to really appreciate where we've come with lung transplantation specifically. Man has been fascinated with organ transplantation all the way back to Homer's Iliad. The chimera was this mythical beast with the head of a lion and a tail of a serpent. You can go to medieval texts and you can actually hear of descriptions about transplantation being done in the battlefield. There were nasal transplants and transplants attempted with fingertips. But as time went on, man really hadn't succeeded at transplant until the modern age. And this is a Time magazine article cover that really depicts the modern age of transplantation. This gentleman right here is Dr. Alexis Carroll. Hold on. And Dr. Carroll, I'll show this to you. Dr. Carroll is the gentleman with the surgical hat on. Whoops. Okay, thank you. Sure, thanks. So Dr. Carroll is depicted right here with the surgical hat on. This gentleman right behind him, does anybody know who that is? So that's Charles Lindbergh. Let me tell you a fascinating story about this. So Dr. Carroll actually is the father of the vascular anastomosis, the way we attach blood vessels to each other. He had actually pioneered cardiopulmonary bypass specifically, and he's holding the first prototype in his hand right here. And again, the gentleman behind him is Charles Lindbergh, the famous aviator. And you might say, what does Charles Lindbergh have to do with transplantation? Well, interestingly enough, Charles Lindbergh's, his sister-in-law had mitral stenosis. And at that time, we did not know how to perform surgery on the heart. And he had met with Dr. Carroll to discuss cardiopulmonary bypass. And again, Dr. Carroll had pioneered this. And this is how Charles Lindbergh got embedded into the history of modern transplantation. But lung transplantation and the history of lung transplantation really doesn't start until the 1940s. Demarkov and Mitrios actually perfected anastomotic transplants in dogs, and it was that led us to the first human lung transplant in 1963. And the first human lung transplant patient is right here. His name was J.R. This was performed actually at the University of Mississippi by Dr. Hardy, who's pictured right here, and I'll talk a little bit about him. This was the actual surgery. And when this surgery was done, they had selected JR as the candidate. He was a gentleman that had emphysema. He had chronic renal insufficiency and left mainstem bronchogenic carcinoma, not the best candidate. The donor that he received the organs from died of an MI and had pulmonary edema. JR got transplanted and lived about 18 days. This is when we had nothing but radiation, azathioprine, and no HLA matching. There were not specialized drugs for transplant, so it was a miracle he lived for even 16 days. He ended up dying of renal failure and infection. And actually, when they did autopsy of his lungs, he had no evidence of rejection whatsoever, which was amazing. And really, this sort of event catapulted transplant into being possibly a therapy for end-stage lung disease. Just a few words about Dr. Hardy, because I think he's such a fascinating individual. Most of you have heard of xenotransplants. This is a sixth grader's picture about Dr. Hardy. It was his sort of ode to Dr. Hardy, and you can see the xenotransplant that Dr. Hardy had performed. He was the first doctor to do a xenotransplant from a monkey. The little sixth grader painted the monkey right here, and here is the patient and Dr. Hardy here. As we know, xenotransplant really hasn't hit its era yet or its success yet, but Dr. Hardy was at the beginning of this as well. So going back to the lung transplant timeline, I think it's important to note that we really went on to doing more transplants after 1963. In fact, 40 transplants were performed worldwide. Most of these patients never left the hospital, and then lung transplantation kind of fell out of favor. People were thinking, why are we doing this? Is this going to be successful? But then in 1978, cyclosporin was invented. And after the advent of cyclosporin, thoracic transplant really hit a therapeutic arena where it could be used for end-stage lung disease. And in 1981, the first successful heart-lung transplant was performed. In 1983, a single lung transplant was performed. And then in 1993, we began to do living donor transplantation. I'm sorry, there's an N missing off of there. So living donor transplantation, I'm just going to say a few words about it, is really reserved for people with small thoracic cavities. Right now in the United States, we're not performing many living donor transplantations. And really worldwide, the only country that's readily using living donor transplantation is Japan, because of the height of the recipients and also because of many of the same donor issues that you face here in the Middle East with limited donors being available. In 2005, we had the first successful EVLP, or ex vivo lung perfusion lung transplant, and I'll talk about ex vivo a little bit at the end of my presentation. Now we're performing over 4,000 transplants across the world. This is data from the International Society of Heart Lung Transplant just in the last year, and you can see the purple bars show us the double lung transplants that are being performed worldwide. The green bars are showing us single lung transplants, and you can see the volumes that have increased worldwide. It's pretty exponential. Interestingly enough, if you look throughout the world to figure out who's doing the most number of transplants, North America, of course, has a large number of transplants. There are a few centers in the Middle East and in Africa that are performing transplants, and Europe is doing quite a few transplants. I'd like to show this slide because to do more than 50 transplants in 1 year is a rare thing. There's only a few centers that do this. In Europe, there's only 6 centers. In North America, only 9 centers perform over 50 transplants a year. And then Australia and other centers, only 1 center actually performs over 50 transplants. At the Cleveland Clinic, where I practice, we hold the world record for the most number of transplants. We did 159 transplants in 2009. In the last year, we did 107 transplants. So we usually do over 100 transplants a year. And that just gives you an idea. We're not talking about huge volumes like kidney transplant or liver transplant, but we're talking about a couple hundred patients in the United States, a little over 1,000 in the United States. But these patients that we do select many times look like this. And this is one patient I wanted to share with you. We were talking about the good, the bad, and the very ugly. Why don't we start off with the good? And I'll also end with the good. This was my cystic fibrosis patient that was transplanted a few years ago. He actually was an ambulance worker, and he had hemoptysis, was admitted to the hospital, and he had the highest CO2 that was ever seen at the Cleveland Clinic before he was intubated. His CO2 was 160. We ended up subsequently getting double organs for him, and you can see it here. And this is what he looked like 3 months after transplant. So before we talk about the ugly, I think it's important for you to look at the successes that we've had. So once the surgeons have done what they do, then we go on to figuring out what we need to do as pulmonologists. So I'm just going to ask a question to the audience to see how familiar you are with lung transplantation. Although I know we don't have an audience response system, just raise your hand or yell out an answer. What is the 5-year survival for a lung transplant patient? Is it 90 to 95%, 70 to 75%, 95 to 99%, or is it about 47 to 57%, or is it 20 to 30%? Any guesses out there?
D.
Okay, who said D? Because whoever said D, you obviously learned something on your rotation. It's about 47 to 57%. Dr. Iskandar actually did lung transplantation rotations in France. So the survival in lung transplantation, it does lag behind other solid organ transplants. And this is despite all advances that we've had in surgery and in prophylaxis. In the last 3 decades, again, the surgical results, the early outcomes have improved, but the long-term outcomes have not improved. The limited survival is mainly due to over-immunosuppression and under-immunosuppression. Remember, the lungs are always exposed to the environment, to toxins, viruses, and the lungs themselves contain a significant amount of lymphoid tissue. Again, this is data from the International Society for Heart-Lung Transplant. And you can see here, the early survival may have improved a little bit. When you go down further, and this is looking at different eras, this is the earliest era, and this is the most recent era in red. The slope of the line has not changed, and we don't see this changing until our immunosuppression and the way we administer our immunosuppression to figure out what the net state of immunosuppression is. Until that changes, I don't see this changing. This is what holds us back, and this is why we have so many of the ugly results in transplantation. So I'm going to move on to ask, when do you transplant a patient? When should you refer a patient? When should a patient be put on the list? When should a patient actually have the transplant? Well, that's a difficult question. What we know is that we only perform transplants for end-stage lung disease when there's no other medical or surgical therapies that are available. For a successful outcome, candidates must undergo rigorous testing, and I'll show you some of that testing. They cannot have other comorbidities, and they should be healthy enough to actually have a good outcome. Pretty simple. You should only have single organ failure. And most of these patients have an inherent risk with transplants, so the timing of listing is absolutely essential. And the timing for referral and listing is important. You don't want to list someone too early, and you don't want to list them when it's too late. And this is depicted well on this side. So in an ideal world where we understand every single lung disease and its natural course, we know that these diseases will stay stable, and then suddenly they'll drop off. And that, again, is in an ideal world. Whoops. Going back. You would have a window, as we call it, for transplantation right here. If you do it too late or too soon, that's not the right time. But again, we don't understand the natural course of all diseases in lung transplantation or in general in pulmonary. So the reality is, in our world, what we end up seeing is this. We see disease states that go up and down, they improve, they get worse, and then we miss this window. They may actually become too late. So that transplant window can be very questionable. So why do we transplant? What diseases? Well, these are the four major categories that we transplant for: restrictive lung diseases, obstructive lung diseases, cystic lung diseases, and vascular diseases. And I'll go through these a little bit more in detail. But if you want real detail on when to send your patients for referral, I would refer you to David Weil's consensus document for the selection of lung transplant candidates that came out in 2014 and finally published in 2015 from the International Society for Heart and Lung Transplant. It's a wonderful document. It follows, gives you really great guidelines on what physiological parameters you need to follow for transplant referral. This is just some of the testing that our patients have to go through. It's over 30 different tests that they'll have to go through at periodic intervals, needing to be repeated and updated as a patient is being considered for transplant. Subsequently, when they're listed, many of these patients have to repeat these tests to improve their allocation score or their place on the list. So again, this is constant testing that these patients have to go through as they're being considered for a transplant. Again, this is a nice data review of why we transplant, what disease states. We do both single and double lungs. And single lungs are usually reserved for the non-suppurative lung diseases, the diseases not like cystic fibrosis, not like bronchiectasis. That's what we do a double lung for. Patients with pulmonary hypertension will undergo usually double lung transplants. The most common reason for a lung transplant in worldwide right now is still COPD. You can see both for single and double lungs, and it's followed by IPF. In the United States, the number one reason for a lung transplant is idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis. So let me ask you one more question. A 60-year-old male from the U.S. comes to visit Lebanon, and he has a left single lung transplant, and he tells you he's had 2 days of swelling, shortness of breath, and a low-grade temperature. What's your diagnosis? And you can see this is a beautiful illustration of a single lung. Here's his transplanted lung, his hyperinflated COPD lung on the right-hand side. A, does he have a PE? B, does he have a viral infection? C, does he have acute cellular rejection? Or D, does he have chronic rejection? Or E, you don't know because you were sleeping through my lecture. Any guesses?
C.
Okay, very good. So it is actually C. It's acute cellular rejection. So a couple of things about acute cellular rejection. These patients could be asymptomatic. They could actually come in with fever. They could come in with infiltrates that you could see. And you could see on this chest x-ray a little bit of a cloudiness or an infiltrate here at the base of this left lung. or these patients could have frank hypoxemia. Many times they will have their own spirometers that they will bring with them. They are supposed to check it in the morning and the evening, and you can see a 10% drop in their FEV1 and FVC. Or you could call their transplant center and see if your testing in your office is similar to what they were doing at home or at their transplant center. It's very common to have acute cellular rejection in the first year. Almost 90% of patients will have it. It usually occurs in about 40 patients within the first 90 days of transplant. And during the first year, you can expect your patient to have at least one or two episodes of rejection. How do we treat it? We increase steroids. We augment their immunosuppression. But with doing that, we leave them open for more infections. Now, again, it can be occult, it could be asymptomatic, so we usually biopsy these patients. Why is it important to biopsy these patients? Because if you continue to have repeated rejections, they could end up having chronic rejection. And we'll talk about that in a few slides. At the Cleveland Clinic, we are a transplant center that biopsies, and this is our time frame for our biopsy. So you're looking at patients that are going to have at least 6 or 7 surveillance bronchoscopies in their first year. If they have a rejection, they'll end up having another biopsy done. So how do we make the diagnosis? Transbronchial biopsies is gold standard. We look for perivascular infiltrates that are seen here in this slide. And depending on the infiltration of the type of cells, that will grade how severe the rejection is. The most severe is an A4. An A3 is a pretty bad rejection. We don't see that often. I usually see maybe about 2 or 3 a year. Most patients present with what we call an A1 rejection or an A2 rejection, which are easily treated with steroids again. Now, let me ask you another question. What's the most common cause of death leading to limited long-term survival in lung transplant? Why do we only have a survival of 47 to 57%? Is it cancer? Is it renal failure? Is it primary graft dysfunction? Is it chronic rejection or chronic lung allograft dysfunction? Or is it rejection, acute cellular rejection, like in the previous question? So if you said D, you are absolutely correct, and we're going to talk about that. This is, again, data from the International Society of Heart Lung Transplant, and you can see this red line, and this is time from the time of transplant. And as patients get out from their first year, their incidence of chronic rejection increases exponentially. Chronic rejection is the number one killer for our patients. So a few statements about chronic rejection. It was first described in 1984. The pathology of chronic rejection is actually scarring and fibrosis, total obliteration of the small airways. Most of the time, we don't find this on biopsy. Unlike acute rejection, which we find on biopsy, chronic rejection we don't really find often. Since we don't find it on biopsy often, the way we look for it is through PFTs, spirometries. We look at a drop in FEV1 and mid-flows. That actually helps us. And is there a treatment for it? Not really. Retransplant is probably the best treatment. We can try to change immunosuppression. We can try other modes of photopheresis, plasmapheresis, but they're not very effective. So really, retransplant is the number one reason treatment for chronic rejection. Again, these patients come in with progressive airflow. You can see it rapidly, as in restrictive lung allograft rejection, and they can go on to having frank hypoxemia, and they have a very poor survival if they do have what we call RAS, or restrictive lung allograft dysfunction. If it's obstructive, their lung parameters will go down slowly. You always need to do a bronchoscopy when you have a patient that has a drop in lung function. Why? Because many times they can come in with stenosis or they can come in with infection. This is a normal airway in a lung transplant patient or a normal anastomosis. You can see the suture lines here. And this is a patient that has an abnormal airway, obviously. This was a young girl that we had. She had quite a marked stenosis here that wasn't known, and she had a progressive drop in her PFTs. We went in, we did electrocautery and opened up this airway, and she had a significant improvement in her PFTs. This next slide just illustrates all the different responses and epithelial injury and all the factors that are involved. We're not going to go through it in detail because I only have 30 minutes to speak to you, but even this is outdated. We are learning more and more about what leads to chronic rejection, and so we're still going to have more complicated slides that look like this. Now let me go on to the next issue. It's infection in our transplant patients. This leads to death as well. In the first year, and you can see that right here on this x-axis, this green line really spikes. That's infection. Why does it do that? Because your immunosuppressive drugs are at the highest level in the first year. And patients are open to viral infections, fungal infections, bacterial infections, and you can see everything in the gamut of every type of infection in lung transplant patients because of their exposure to the air. Even a common cold could be a death sentence for our patients. There are certain treatments that we do employ for our patients if they have respiratory viruses, if they have RSV, or if they have influenza or parainfluenza. Some of these viruses will actually initiate an immune response in these patients, leading to lung function loss and acute rejection, and then subsequently chronic rejection. So we have to be very, very vigilant about infections in our patients. This was a patient that came in to see me just last week, and I thought it was such a fascinating slide. She was a 48-year-old female with sarcoid, a lot of lung infections with Pseudomonas. She happened to mention to me her eye was watering on the left side and that she had headaches, and I sent her to ophthalmology. She ended up having 70% necrosis due to HSV retinitis. She's probably going to end up losing her eyesight. Otherwise, she was doing fine 3 weeks prior to this. She's now getting intraocular foscarnet and acyclovir systemically. And again, she'll probably lose her eyesight. And this is just one example of the type of infections that we deal with. So let me talk about, lastly, malignancy. And you can see malignancy occurs at a greater rate as you go out from transplant. And this is shown by the yellow line again on this data from the International Society of Heart Lung Transplant. So there's a higher prevalence of malignancy in our population compared to other solid organs. In fact, if you live 5 years, if you're lucky enough to make it through chronic rejection, acute rejection, you're going to end up having cancer, most commonly skin cancers. And the 10-year prevalence of having a cancer is about 25%. This is a patient of mine that went to see his barber, and his barber noticed these small black dots. And then when we looked at the top of his forehead, he had these dots that had coalesced. When we sent him to dermatology, this turned out to be melanoma. 2 weeks later, he had metastatic spread to his lungs, and he died 2 weeks after that. So within 4 weeks of the diagnosis and presentation, he was dead. This is absolutely the case that we see in these sort of patients. They will get these cancers and they will spread rapidly. Melanoma is the most extreme example. Squamous basal cells, very common, and we see this often. We also will see prostate cancer, breast cancer, and lung cancers, especially in the transplanted lung and in the native lung. And these are not donor derived. Saying all this, though, the majority of our patients go on, some of them go back to work, some of them work part-time, some full-time. A lot of them are not working, mainly because in the United States, with health insurance and coverage for meds, they will, if they go back to work, they'll lose some of their privileges and some of their access to insurance. So they would rather stay on Medicaid so that they would still get their medications paid for and their office visits. So you always have to end a negative note on a positive note. And this is not a lung transplant patient, but I'll tell you a story. This is actually a doctor. His name is Dr. Timothy Francisco. In the summer times, he would do this. And he's an orthopedic surgeon. He got diagnosed with Castleman's disease, went on oxygen, ended up having a child. But then he underwent a double lung transplant. And this is Tim now, and you can see him right here. He'll never get the muscle mass back that he had before because of the drugs that we use. But he's living his life. He's now 10 years out of transplant, enjoying everything, and his lung function is absolutely stable. Let's go on to talking about some novel therapies in transplant. So there are a couple of new advents or inventions in bridging patients with respiratory failure that have led to improvements in early transplantation outcomes. One of the most recent advances is different types of ECMO. This is actually a Novalung, which many of you are familiar with. We're less familiar with it in the United States because it is not FDA approved. And this is basically a CO2 scrubber and allows these patients, in this case, they cannot be ambulatory, but there are newer devices that do allow them to be ambulatory. Ex vivo perfusion that I mentioned before is probably the biggest advent for getting improving donor outcomes and improving donor the amount, number of donor lungs. What we basically do is take lungs that are not considered appropriate or suboptimal, and we recondition them. And they're reconditioned actually in this reservoir. They're taken out of the donor, and then they're subsequently treated, and they could be treated with different gene transfers for IL-8, IL-10 to decrease inflammation and actually make these lungs more usable. Many times when donors die of certain sort of trauma or brain injury, they will have a flooding of their lungs with neurogenic edema, and these lungs won't be good enough to use. We can actually take them from the donor, put them on this device, and actually dry out the lungs, which we wouldn't be able to do with diuretics, and make these lungs usable. The time you can spend on this device is about 6 hours. There's a couple of different devices that are currently on the market: VivaLine, Ex Vivo, and OCS. OCS is an ambulatory system which you can actually take out to the field. The other ones are not ambulatory systems, but are excellent systems that are getting more and more use.
Dr. Budev, still have 1 minute.
Okay. Immunotolerance is what we're aiming for. Eventually, hopefully, we won't have any drugs that we'll have to use, and we'll avoid some of the bad complications because we won't be working as much as we are with the immune system and manipulating it. Our hope is that one day donors and recipients would take on chimerism and develop tolerance to each other. Tissue engineering is being looked at now, but we're really, really far behind. We've been able to engineer rat lungs. These have survived for about 7 days, not really much longer than that. We've really got a long way to go with this. And I'm going to stop on a happy note and show you a video of a patient of mine who's had a double lung transplant, who is a soprano opera singer.
Are we just going to do a thing? And
we're just going to sing.
Okay.
That's what I do.
Let's see if we can play this.
Are we just going to do a thing? And
we're just going to sing.
Okay.
So that's what I do.
And this is my patient right here. And she said two double lung transplants.
That's not the right song.
I don't want to sing the wrong song. We could try. It might be entertaining.
She got some good donor lungs. Stop, and I'll be happy to take any questions. I'm sorry this was such a quick lecture, but I took you through the whirlwind of transplantation. I'll be happy to answer any questions that you have. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Budev, for this interesting topic. We don't have enough time for questions, so we will move to the next session.